Hey there, I'm Bruce Dinsmore. This is number 0525, the Stuff File program, with the one and only Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0525. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Stephen Taibbi, who is the author of Grateful Guilt, Living in the Shadow of My Heart. Besides having gone through two heart transplants, his medical journey started with surgeries that took place at birth. Why the title, Grateful Guilt?
I'm a two-time heart transplant recipient. Not all of us, but I'd say 90-something percent of us have survivor's guilt in getting that organ, and the fact that we know that somebody died. Now, somebody could tell us all they want, that they didn't die for us, they were going to die anyway, and all that. But it doesn't assuage us very much because we just have this guilt about it. My first transplant, the guilt was almost crushing for me, but you're grateful at the same time. And also, when I was a child, my illness, I'm pretty sure, is what split up the family, and I had guilt about that, so Grateful Guilt seemed like a good title.
Angela Crocker is the author of Digital Legacy Plan. What should you do with your digital footprint after you die?
There are many people that don't have any interest in having any kind of themselves continue to exist, yet there are companies that are actively working to develop the artificial intelligence software that would allow an interactive avatar of yourself to continue living, that your great-great-great-grandchildren could come and ask you, you know, tell me the story of when you went to school, or talk to me about what it was like to cook in your kitchen, or more specific things to your particular expertise.
Colin McIntosh is the founder of a sustainable bed linen company called Sheets and Giggles.
Prior to starting SNG, and that's what I call Sheets and Giggles because I can't say the name over and over without making myself laugh, I started SNG in October 2017 after I had just been laid off on a Monday at 1 p.m. from my last startup, which was a wearable tech startup. It was a really difficult and emotional experience for me, and so I think that I learned a lot from the 3 years that I ran business development at that company, and unfortunately it didn't work out. I mean, the whole team basically got laid off at the same time.
And we have Doug Price on life, lots of Stuff File news, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0525, was Montreal actor Bruce Dinsmore. He will soon be seen on stage starring in Billy Bishop Goes to War at the Hudson Village Theater just outside of Montreal in October and November. And on the small screen, he'll be playing the President of the United States in a new French comedy on Radio-Canada called La Maison Bleue. Thank you very much, Bruce, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff. Well, actually, before we get to the first story, I want to bring up the Washington Generals. Now, anyone who's ever seen the Harlem Globetrotters knows that their long-suffering nemesis is the Washington Generals. The Generals have been playing against and losing to the Globetrotters since the 1950s. Now, depending on where you search, it's been said that the Generals have won either only 3 games or 6 games. Either way, that's an extremely dismal track record. The only record that's worse than that is the record of District Attorney Hamilton Berger against Perry Mason. Hamburger only won twice. Actually, in life, there is one entity that has a worst record. It's the battle of chickens versus humans. Well, now we can chalk one up for the fowl. An elderly Australian woman collected eggs from a chicken coop in her backyard and was killed after being pecked by her pet rooster. According to the Daily Mirror, the woman died after her rooster reportedly punctured one of her varicose veins. As a result, she began bleeding profusely. While the unidentified woman received a number of other injuries, her cause of death was listed as bleeding. The blood flow could not be stopped. The tragic incident has triggered a warning to the elderly about dealing with animals that are usually considered harmless and about tending to their varicose veins. Said Professor Roger Bayard, "Most importantly, I'm trying to get elderly people to have varicose veins treated with a simple operation because they are especially vulnerable to being broken." So, if you're keeping score, it's humans infinity, chickens one. Actually, let me break from the norm here even more than I did earlier. Between this show and my old radio show, I've been doing Stuff File News now for about 30 years. Now, one of my favorite stories of all time became the title of a book. I'll share that title of the book with you in just a few moments. But let me share the story, which came from Reuters back in the early 1990s. Six people, including four from the same family, drowned when they jumped into a well to save a chicken in South Egypt. The chicken had fallen into a farmer's well in the village of Nazlet Emara in Sohag province. The farmer's 18-year-old son quickly dived in to try to save it, but slipped and drowned. His two brothers and a sister, aged 20, 16, and 14 respectively, jumped in one after the other to save him, but all met the same fate. Two neighbors who came to the siblings' rescue also drowned. A police team, which removed the corpses from the well, found the chicken alive and floating in the water. Okay, this is a story I'll never forget. And if you'd like to read stories just like that, then I suggest you get a copy of the paperback book, Six Drowned Saving Chicken and Other True Stories from the Reuters Oddly Enough File. It came out in 1996, and it is a hoot. I've put an Amazon link to it on this week's page for the Stuff File website, so you can click on the link and pick up the book for less than $3. I promise you'll enjoy it. Okay, how sound of a sleeper are you? I'm willing to bet not as sound as this senior citizen. An unnamed woman fell asleep in her car at around 9 p.m., parked in her own driveway in Hamilton Township, New Jersey. When the 80-year-old woke up 7 hours later, she realized she was no longer in her car, but rather lying in her driveway. Police are classifying the theft as a carjacking. They found the empty car in nearby Trenton and so far have no suspects. Wow. I'm sure if and when they catch the thief, they will no doubt object to the carjacking charge because they probably figured the woman was dead. Also, can you imagine how disorienting it must have been to fall asleep in a car, then wake up on the ground, and you're trying to figure out how the heck you got there? Yikes. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, speaking of car thefts, police in Kennewick, Washington, responded to a report of a stolen pickup. William Kelly admitted to officers he had left his keys on his seat and some slimy opportunist stole his 1992 Chevy. A surveillance camera in the commercial district caught the theft on tape. A man on a bicycle spotted the keys and took the vehicle. Investigators also figured out what Kelly was doing on the street at 6 a.m. He was, they say, stealing from a business across the street and arrested him on burglary charges. Yeah, low-down scum meets slimy opportunist. And it's a two-for-one for the cops. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Stephen Taibbi is someone who has always been told that he's living on borrowed time. He was operated on right after birth. He was told on three occasions that he only had a year to live. He wasn't supposed to make it past 5 years old, then six, then 10. He had a near-fatal heart incident when he was 17. He was told he would never make it into his 20s. And there's more, which we'll get to. Stephen is the author of Grateful Guilt, Living in the Shadow of My Heart. And he joins us on the line from New York. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Peter. How are you doing?
Jess Tickety-Boo, thanks very much for being on the program with us. You have such a compelling story, and I really don't know where to begin, but let's start with the title of your book, Grateful Guilt. What do you mean by that?
Well, I'm a two-time heart transplant recipient, and not all of us, but I'd say 90-something percent of us have survivor's guilt in getting that organ, and the fact that we know that somebody died. Now, somebody could tell us all they want that they didn't die for us, they were going to die anyway and all that, but it doesn't assuage us very much because we just have this guilt about it. My first transplant, the guilt was almost crushing for me. But you're grateful at the same time. And also, when I was a child, my illness, I'm pretty sure, is what split up the family, and I had guilt about that. So Grateful Guilt seemed like a good title.
By the way, I should mention you have a website for the book called GratefulGuilt.com, and people should go to that website and check out the trailer you have for the book. It's a very compelling story. Not only did you have to suffer through all of the things you went through physically because of your heart condition as a child, but you were also bullied in school. I mean, you had it coming every which way at you.
Yeah, it kind of seemed like that sometimes.
How did you find the perseverance to get through that? Because, you know, a lesser person would have just collapsed and crumbled.
I don't know. I mean, I know that my book is really a story about perseverance, but when I was living through it, I wasn't thinking of it that way. I was just putting my head down and getting through it all. That's all. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Am I making myself clear there?
Absolutely. So let's go back to the beginning, and that is, what were your parents like in bringing you up? How positive of a force were they? Because, I mean, your positivity has to come from somewhere.
I'm sorry?
Your positivity has to come from somewhere.
Yes, it did. Well, my parents, when I was ill, wouldn't allow me to act like I was ill. They wouldn't mollycoddle me. They made me do things. They made me do things probably doctors wouldn't have wanted them to want me to do. And I kind of picked up on that and ran with it even more. And I just, you know, if my doctor told me I wasn't able to do something or I shouldn't do something, I went out and did it just because I thought that would make me stronger. Right down to the point where my doctor wouldn't let me become a pilot, and I found out that I could become a glider pilot without a doctor's note, so I became a pilot. So that just became my way of being, and it started with my parents.
Okay, so again, back to the beginning. You were operated, as I mentioned, right after birth. What was the reason for that operation, your first operation, basically?
I had three operations at birth. I had both of my thumbs, a tendon was pulling them sideways. That's what the doctors thought. They didn't realize that it was a birth defect that included my heart. And they operated on my thumbs, and they also operated on another minor area.
Okay, so when did you first start having problems with your heart?
Right after birth, but nobody recognized it but my mother, who was a nurse, who kept running around from doctor to doctor trying to get somebody to pay attention. And then finally, my grandfather, we thought, had tuberculosis, so the whole family had to get x-rays. And it was when I had that x-ray when I was 5 that they discovered that I had an enlarged heart. And that's when the whole thing started.
Now, as I mentioned, on several occasions, you were told that you weren't going to live beyond a certain period of time. When you're told this once, now, again, you were very young at the time. You were 5, you were 6, and then you were 10 when this happened. But at what point do you kind of get the feeling, gee, these people seem to want me dead?
Well, my parents were told the first two, like when I was 5 and 6, that was the first two times they said I wouldn't make it. Then they were told that they were told that I wouldn't get past 10 and that I wouldn't get out of my teens. I hadn't been told that, but when I was a teen, I had a doctor who was very honest with me, and that was the first time. And he told me that I had a year to live when I was 16, and I almost died on my 17th birthday with a heart incident that actually had an out-of-body experience connected to it. That was the first time I was told. And then the next two times were when I needed heart transplants, and they said, either you get the heart in a year or you're not here.
Now, is it true that with all the trouble you had with your heart growing up, you seemed to get past that, and that the reasons for the heart transplants were not necessarily related to what you were dealing with as a child?
Yeah, this is the really funny part, because the doctors kept telling me I wouldn't get, even my doctor told me I wouldn't get out of my 20s, and then when I was 34, he said, I don't know what you did, but your heart's completely normal. And then like 10 years later, I caught a virus that killed my heart. It had nothing to do with my childhood. It was just God being funny.
Wow. And that brings up another point. I mean, how do you feel, as you say, God being funny, how do you feel like you're being targeted in some way, shape, or form? Like, do you ever sit around and go, what next can happen to me?
Unfortunately, because I'm human, I do that once in a while, but I don't let that hold. I try instead to, when I get like that, I shake it off as quickly as I can, and I try to get back into an attitude of gratitude. I mean, the fact that I'm even here right now, I mean, I'm pretty darn grateful. And, you know, I've had two donors who helped me live, and all my doctors, all my nurses, my wife has been incredible. I mean, I shouldn't be here. Nobody thought I'd get to be as old as I am, and yet here I am. So when I get those kind of feelings, I try to shake them off as fast as I can, because I feel like that's kind of being ungrateful, and I get back into the feeling of being grateful.
And may I ask how old you are now?
You can ask. I'll tell you. I guess I'm 66.
66. So there you go. With all that has happened to you, you, as you said earlier, you went against doctor's wishes and you did things that you wanted to do because you felt you could do them, even if they said they didn't. How did you go about deciding what career you wanted to follow? Because I know you went into production. You're a director, a producer, a DP. You've worked on several shows. You've worked with people like Dr. Ruth and Joan London and Joy Philbin and Cyndi Lauper. The list goes on and on and on. How did you decide to get into that particular business?
When I was a Cub Scout, one of my Cub Scout troop members, his father was a Mitch Miller singer, and they took us to see the rehearsal of the Easter show when I was a little kid. And when I saw that TV studio, I was just wowed. And you know, when I was into photography, my father was a photographer. I had my first camera when I was five, and it just kind of naturally pulled me that way. I loved going into television.
Excellent, excellent. So now you've written this book. The book is called Grateful Guilt, Living in the Shadow of My Heart. At what point did you decide you were going to write this book, and who do you feel your prime audience is? Who do you want to reach with this book?
I wrote this book because everybody told me I had to write it because of the way I handle being ill and the way I've just handled life and my illnesses and the strategies that I've developed to keep myself here. And that's why I wrote the book. I wrote the book partly to be inspirational, but mostly to use my story as an analogy. And if somebody thinks they're having a hard time, they could read my book, and they could be having a harder time than I had. That's easily enough to do, unfortunately. But it's to give them hope, to let somebody see that there are ways to deal with these things, that your mind and your will and your mental armor are weapons that you can use in the battle for your life. And that's why I wrote the book.
In writing your own story, was this a cathartic experience for you, going through this whole situation of writing your story, sitting down and chronicling all that you've been through?
Yeah, it was. When I wrote the book, I made a decision that a book like this wouldn't have any value to it at all unless I was emotionally naked, is the only way I know how to put it, for this book. I had to be 100% transparent as far as who I am, what I am. And it was a little rough for me to do that because there are some things I admit in here that aren't easy to admit in public, but I figured if the book was going to have any value at all, I had to do that.
And what kind of reaction are you getting from those who are close to you, friends and family, who have now gone through this process of reading your book and realizing there are more layers to you than perhaps they even knew?
That's the number one comment I get, is that people who've known me all my life will say, I had no idea this was happening to you. And of course, because, you know, I don't complain, and I don't talk about those things because they're my things to deal with. I don't expect them to talk to me about their things, you know. So I imagine if anybody else were to write a book, you know, with the level of honesty that I wrote mine, that I would say the same thing to them, though, you know?
Well, it's a fascinating story, and congratulations on getting your book out. And more importantly, congratulations on surviving everything you've been through. It's an amazing journey. I thank you very much, Stephen, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Stephen Taibbi, author of Grateful Guilt, Living in the Shadow of My Heart. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0525, and you'll find links to Stephen's site, and you should really see the trailer that I mentioned of his book, which is on his site. Plus, you'll also find links to Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Choosy mothers choose the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. If your mother didn't choose it for you, well, I guess she just doesn't love you.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to the co-author of Digital Legacy Plan. Plus, we'll meet the founder and CEO of Sheets and Giggles. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. Much more Stuff File news. And oh yeah, Doug Price on Life. Here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Podcast and Apple Podcast, and also Spotify. Just click on the Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, or Spotify buttons located on the website at thestufffile.com. And whichever platform you listen to the program on, please, please, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Well, let's get back to the stuff, shall we? A senior citizen is blaming his dog for racking up charges for pay-per-view porn. It's an excuse that's bound to give pause, but Thomas Barnes claims he has a horn dog in Pet Merino. The North Carolina man said he was shocked, when he received a $70 bill from DirecTV for ordering a cinematic Boinkorama from the Hustler channel. He was outraged and blamed his Bichon Frise Merino for the porno purchase. Barnes said his curious canine jumped up on his bed and landed on the remote control, accidentally ordering from the channel. The senior immediately contacted DirecTV and explained the situation. "There's a problem when there's a mistake, and you expect me to pay for a mistake." That's what he said. Now that I'm thinking about it, isn't it his mistake? Shouldn't he have to pay for it? Anyway. He also added that the company promised to make good on the error, but he still had access to Hustler for weeks after, and when the bill arrived, he subtracted the cost of the channel and paid the rest. DirecTV cut off Barnes' service. "That's $70, you're taking food out of my mouth," said the senior, who relies on his Social Security benefits to survive. "It's like you're stealing it." They refused to see how that was pertinent. After Barnes complained to the FCC, DirecTV backed down. Well, I hate to be cruel, but I didn't realize DirecTV was a right, not a privilege. You know, there are a lot of things that people like to blame on the dog, but I didn't realize porn was one of them. And finally, on the Stuff File Facebook fan page, I often put up stories that for one reason or another don't necessarily fit into the show. Now, late last week, I added the story about a guy in Tennessee who was suing the Popeye chicken chain because they ran out of the popular sandwich that had only launched on August the 12th. You can go to our Facebook fan page and read that story. I only bring it up because of another situation at another Popeye's for the same reason. a Popeyes customer in Houston, Texas, pulled a gun on staff for a chicken sandwich. The customer grew upset after being told the restaurant had sold out of chicken sandwiches. He had come with four others, all believed to be in their late teens and early 20s, at around 8:45 p.m. The new chicken sandwich, which the man grew so upset about, has been wildly popular across the U.S. for the past month, with Americans forming long lines to try it. After the group threatened the staff, the suspect pulled out the weapon and demanded they make him a sandwich anyway, even though the restaurant didn't have the ingredients. No shots were fired, and the suspect and friends left the scene before officers arrived. No arrests were made, but police are checking video surveillance. Wow. What's in this chicken? I mean, people lining up for blocks, people suing, people threatening gun violence? That's not chicken, that's crack! So, again, if you're keeping score on this program, it's humans infinity, chickens seven. Hopefully no one at Popeyes has varicose veins. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Angela Crocker is back on the program. Back in 2011, we had her on to talk about her book, The Complete Idiot's Guide to Creating a Social Network. Well, Angela is the co-author of a new book called Digital Legacy Plan, a guide to the personal and practical elements of your digital life before you die. Angela joins us via Skype from British Columbia. Hi, Angela.
Hello there.
Nice to have you back on the program with us. As I said to you just before we went to air, I'm one of those people who, when someone passes away that's a friend of mine on Facebook, and I know it sounds cold, I unfriend them immediately. And I'm hoping that when my time goes, someone takes down all of my social media. All of it.
Well, I'm sure we're all taking note that that is your wish. You've yes. made it. This is a public record right here. I think it's interesting that you're so definite about it. My co-author, Vicki McLeod, and I, as we were researching the book, we talked to a whole bunch of people about what they wanted. And some people don't care. They're like, I don't mind. I'll be a digital zombie for the rest of eternity. No problem. Other people like you are very definite about delete it all, shut it down, make it go away. And there's a lot of people around the world who haven't given it any thought whatsoever and are really sort of horrified that, oh, yeah, there's a digital footprint that's going to live on beyond this conversation.
And
what are we going to do about it?
And not only that, the problem I see is that, let's be honest, more people are born, more people will die. As time goes on, the number of dead people online will grow and grow and grow. And my question is, why?
Well, I think it's a matter of, you know, who wants to live on and who doesn't. There are many people that don't have any interest in having any kind of them of themselves continue to exist. Yet there are companies that are actively working to develop the artificial intelligence software that would allow an interactive avatar of yourself to continue living, that your great-great-great-grandchildren could come and ask you, you know, tell me the story of when you went to school, or talk to me about what it was like to cook in your kitchen, or more, you know, specific things to your particular expertise. Whatever your digital footprint is going to show a specific version of you, and we all polish up what we put online a little bit, don't we?
So what made you come up with this idea, you and your co-writer, to come up with this idea about a digital legacy plan? At what point did you say, I think this is an issue that we need to tackle?
Well, Vicki McLeod and I both came to it separately in sort of slightly different directions. Vicki has an earlier book, it's called Untrending, and it's talking about how we live with social media, and you know, kind of part of what she says in there is, what does your social media footprint say to the future? What do you want your legacy message to be? She even asked the question in the book, if your last social media post was your epitaph, your long-lasting statement to the world, you know, what does it say about you? Like, if is it about your avocado toast? Well, maybe that's really central to who you are, but maybe not. Concurrently, I was doing some work around digital decluttering. I have an earlier book called Declutter Your Data. And that book was inspired by my personal experience managing my mother and later my grandmother's estates. And my mom, we knew that she was not well. We knew that she only had a few months left. we did not talk about her technology at all. We talked about lots of other things. And after she'd passed on, I realized I did not have the password to her personal laptop. And it made me really pause and realize, okay, what have I got? I have a huge social profile. I have many, many social media accounts. My husband, he doesn't do social media. You will not find him on any platform, almost. So how do we, you know, how do we navigate? How does he know what to do to go in to look at my stuff? Do I want to be deleted? Do I not want to be deleted? It created all of these questions. Concurrently, Vicky's asking similar questions, and we've come together to create the Digital Legacy Plan, and it's both an emotional guide as well as a very practical guide. We want people to be able to put together a plan so they're not lying awake at night worrying about this, along with worrying about, is their will up to date, and did they remember to let the cat in, and, you know, all the things that keep us up at night. This does not have to be one of them.
Now, I know for a fact, having dealt with the funeral industry on old radio shows, and the fact that I actually have, for lack of a better term, a layaway plan, that a lot of people are very skittish about talking about what happens to them or to their person or to their property after they die. So is this another thing to add to that list that people don't want to talk about?
Well, it's a very personal journey. Some people are needing the prompt to think about it, which gets them talking about it. You know, every media piece they come across that's related to this book, every time they see the book on the bookstore shelves or in their personal library, they're getting that little nudge. It is something that people are uncomfortable about. We even talk in the book, we spend some time talking about, you know, the taboos of death, and talking about death and dying is not something that we do regularly. And also talking about, you know, how do we open those conversations with our loved ones, with our professional colleagues even. For some people, this topic is more palatable. If you think about it as winning the lottery and leaving your job and you're just walking away, there's no transition period, there's no nothing. Well, what's in your email at the office? What passwords do your colleagues need? What documents do they need access to? Suddenly, there's a lot going on just in the work environment, and then you multiply that by your personal environment where you're more likely to find controversial private discussions. Maybe you're complaining about your mother-in-law. Maybe you're complaining about your kids. Ranting and venting in those ways in supposedly private forums can be very healthy, but it's not healthy for them if they uncover that correspondence after you're gone. So you have to think about what's going to happen in the future when you are no longer there. Are there people that are going to care, and are they going to be affected by what you've done?
So what's the first step in planning out your digital legacy plan? I mean, I should say your second step, because your first step is buying this book.
Well, yes, please. We would certainly appreciate that. I think the very first step is to really have a think about the scope of your digital footprint. Where do you live online? Where do you have information? Even if you don't have a robust social media life, you may have lots of shopping accounts. Maybe you have gaming accounts. Maybe you have a complex online banking. You're a small business owner and you've got conventional banking as well as PayPal and Square and other sort of chargeback platforms where you're taking money in from customers. Really look at your digital footprint and the scope of where you live in terms of technology. And we walk people through it in the book and really give some good prompts to get you to think about areas beyond social media and email. It's so much more than just that.
Would it be fair to say that people who have a digital footprint before they think about it are unaware of how much larger their digital footprint is than they think it is?
Very much so. Almost every person we've talked to has been really surprised at the scope of things that they need to think about.
Wow. So let's say, for argument's sake, someone doesn't plan this out. How difficult is it for, like you just described, your husband isn't online, you have a large footprint. If you don't discuss this with your husband, what's his first step?
Well, in some cases, he may be able to unlock passwords because he has access to my email, as long as that email is still going. I've actually made him a spreadsheet. It's a list of all the places where I have some kind of presence, with some hints around logins and passwords. You know, everyone is unique, and maybe I haven't quite updated it. But for the person who hasn't given it any thought, figuring out access to each individual account can be a very time-consuming process. Some platforms, things like Facebook, for example, have a very clear process. You can actually establish a legacy contact before you die. If you fail to do that, there is a mechanism where you can request as the surviving, you know, the executor, the digital steward, you can make a request to get into that account. The rules and access vary greatly from one platform to another. And the target market for the platforms, you know, the platforms that are so-called for younger users, things like Snapchat and TikTok as we record this. Of course, it'll be all different next week, but at the moment, those are leading tools. They have less information around how you get in. So you're sent, you know, you may end up sending in death certificates and notarized letters and what's your relationship. And it's just an emotional drain to have to do all of that. And even if you do get access, many of these platforms will not give you access to the private messaging because of the privacy rules that you agree to. When you click on, I accept the terms and conditions, well, those terms and conditions are going to be in effect when you're gone as well. And so what if they can't get access to your photographs? Maybe you've kept all your family photos in a social media platform. Well, what if your family can no longer access them? Wow. All for the lack of a single password. That's what's, in a sense, it's a gift to the future. Vicki McLeod, my co-author, she often says that planning is an act of love. And in the digital legacy plan context, just as it gives your loved ones comfort to know what you want done with your physical possessions through your last will and testament, what you want done for your remains in terms of your funeral pre-arrangements, or memorial service, or cremation, or whatever you choose, this is just another layer of that act of love so that your digital life can be dealt with in a way that suits you. And if you don't care, even just telling them, I don't care, that is a plan. It's not the recommended plan, but it is a plan.
It sounds like it's an entire minefield, which is an even more important reason to get the book. The book is the digital legacy plan. I thank you, Angela, for being on the program with us once again. I know you have another book out called Digital Life Skills for Kids. Will you come back with us in about a month or so, and then let's talk about that book as well?
I'd be happy to. Absolutely.
Excellent. Thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
You're most welcome. Thanks for having me on, Peter.
Angela Crocker, author of Digital Legacy Plan, a guide to the personal and practical elements of your digital life before you die. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0525, and you'll find links to Angela's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to check in on Doug Price. You know, even though his surroundings may be Spartan, he really is living the high life.
And now a word about my domestic engineering. How best to describe my humble abode of single occupancy 30 years on? Spartan, sparse, frugal, bare necessities, let's just say luxurious camping, Centreville. That said, rest assured, I did splurge on a couple of amenities like electricity and heating, you know, the necessities, plus to beat the outrageous cost of today's high-tech home security, I even came up with my own idea of the last place an uninvited guest, burglar is such a nasty word, the very last place a friggin' thief would think of looking for my valuables, both of them, passport and Wi-Fi password. In fact, unless the criminal decided to cook up a meal using my stove and oven before robbing me blind, there's no way the crook could ever think of looking in my oven mitts. Shh, bon appetit. Gotcha. Seriously, though, well, I feel completely at home sweet home living with no frills besides running water. I do realize that this is not everyone's cup of tea, so no problem. I don't drink tea. Just my cup of joe, a little pack of brown sugar, okay, a bit of a health nut, and stir. Oh, wait a sec, where'd I put my swizzle stick? Oh, yeah. I'm living the good life. Now it's off to my other indulgences. Hey, you gotta treat yourself, right? You got my flat screen, my killer sound bar, and I gotta say, when I crank up those tunes, it's almost hard to hear my true pride and joy. A brand new 2020 John Deere vacuum cleaner. Ride my e-buddy around the apartment, going room to room. I don't even signal because there's so much space and so good in the corners. I even wear my old hockey helmet. You know, safety first. You can never be too careful at home. I know I haven't mentioned having family or friends over, but I guess that day's going to come and I'm ready. Never mind, bring your own wine. Bring your own chair.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that's now gluten-free.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to the founder and CEO of Sheets and Giggles. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way, and I've got one more Stuff File news story I want to share with you. Here on the Stuff File program, which is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, maybe his conscience got the better of him. On August 13th, a man in a wheelchair approached a teller at a First National Bank on Pittsburgh's South Side. The man, thought to be in his 60s, handed the teller a note demanding cash, but then suddenly abandoned his robbery attempt and exited the bank. Police and FBI agents were on the lookout for the reluctant robber, but there were no photographs or video of him to aid them. Okay, not to be politically incorrect, but I'll be politically incorrect. How do you lose a wheelchair-bound senior citizen potential bank robber? How does that quick getaway happen? Was his chair rocket-fueled? I don't know. Anyway, let's get to our last guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Colin McIntosh is the founder and CEO of a bedding brand called Sheets and Giggles. They make sustainable eucalyptus sheets, and they're a fast-growing direct-to-consumer brand. It's one of the few companies to earn $1 million in revenue in its first 12 months of sales. Colin joins us via Skype from Colorado to talk about his very successful startup. Hi, Colin.
Hey, Peter. How are you doing? Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the program with us. So how did the idea, and by the way, I love the name of the company. How did the idea of this company come to be in the first place?
Well, it's interesting. I actually, prior to starting SNG, and that's what I call Sheets and Giggles because I can't say the name over and over without making myself laugh. I started SNG in October 2017 after I had just been laid off on a Monday at 1 p.m. from my last startup, which was a wearable tech startup. It was a really difficult and emotional experience for me. And so I think that I learned a lot from the 3 years that I ran business development at that company. And unfortunately, it didn't work out. I mean, the whole team basically got laid off at the same time. And I was a little frustrated with how things ended. And so I basically sat down, I built my a business model that I thought I would be best in the world at, is kind of what I said in my head. And then I ended up working through different product ideas and product iterations to come up with a product that I thought fit perfectly within the business model. So it's actually a little bit of the opposite of the way most founders come up with their idea. A lot of folks come up with a problem or a solution to a problem or a product idea and then try to build a business model around it. And I think that that's actually the opposite approach from what people should do, which is build a really strong business model they feel passionately about and then create a product that the market loves that fits within that model.
Okay, so you came up, as I mentioned, with eucalyptus sheets. They're bed sheets and duvet covers that use up to 96% less water to make than cotton sheets. How did you come to this idea in the first place?
Well, so it's actually interesting. So I originally had thought of the idea of doing a sustainable product. So one of the things that I knew about myself is that I was really, you know, at least compared to other folks in my peer group, pretty adept at selling and marketing physical products. And so I really wanted my own consumer brand for myself to go out and make a living. And honest to God, Pete, I wanted a lifestyle company, and I think I got a bit of a tiger by the tail. But the eucalyptus fabric kind of came out of a bunch of research that I was doing in terms of the most sustainable fabrics that, you know, humanity's really ever come up with. I didn't invent the process. I don't own, you know, the IP around this type of product. But it's a very niche product that hasn't seen very widespread market adoption. And so I was diving into different sustainable fabrics, you know, bamboo, hemp, you know, a few other really awesome things that are going on in textiles. And I found this, you know, eucalyptus fiber, which is called eucalyptus lyocell. And it's just fantastic. It's, you know, it's softer than cotton. It's more breathable. It's more durable. And that was one of the things that I really wanted to hone in on, was a sustainable product that was not just – the marketing wasn't just buy it because you're a good person. The marketing was buy it because it's actually better than the current unsustainable option. And by the way, it's sustainable too. And that's kind of how we've approached the marketing. And what I attribute some of our you know, quick come up to is that we're not really approaching it like a typical sustainable product. It's more of an, of course we're sustainable because it's 2019 and we wouldn't start a company otherwise. And so that's how we came up with the eucalyptus fabric. Was it was just this really incredible product that hadn't seen very widespread adoption. And there are only a handful of people in the world that are able to actually manufacture this. And so we ended up partnering with one of the few with that expertise, and it's been a really fantastic partnership.
Well, since it is something that, as you say, is rare, there's not a lot of people making this, and yet it's something that is sustainable and, as you say, better than what's out there. Were you concerned, or are you concerned, about the so-called big boys coming in after you, like sharks, when they see the success that you're having with something that is sustainable?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that there's a couple things I talk about on that. First is that we've spent some time making sure that we built a bit of a moat around our brand as sort of the de facto eucalyptus bedding brand in the space. And so we're the first result on Amazon when you search for eucalyptus sheets. We're the first result on Google when you search for eucalyptus sheets. You know, we own eucalyptussheets.com, eucalyptusbedding.com. You know, I could go on and on about the domains that I buy at 3 a.m. But, you know, it's something that where if Amazon, for example, were to come out with a competitor or Bed Bath, which, you know, Bed Bath actually does have a eucalyptus option in its stores. It's about 50% more expensive than ours. You know, I think that I would love that type of rising category awareness so we could actually be positioned like we currently are to profit off of it. And, you know, right now what I'm doing is I'm actually running podcast ads. You know, not on your program yet, unfortunately. But I'm running some podcast ads that are really creating awareness of the category, similar to the way that bamboo sheets have become part of the vernacular. I really want us to profit off of a rising tide of category awareness. And if more people come into the space, that honestly, that's great news, because it means that Americans and Canadians and other folks are, you know, really coming around to this fabric category and are wanting to adopt it. And honestly, every sheet set that we sell is one less cotton sheet in the world, one less polyester sheet in the world. And so I'm very happy with whoever's making those sales.
As I mentioned in the introduction, it's one of the few companies to earn $1 million of revenue in its first 12 months of sales. Every time someone starts up a business, they have dreams of a certain amount of success. But were you surprised by how well this has done in a short period of time?
Oh, tremendously so. I think, you know, after my last company was venture capital backed, and, you know, I saw firsthand how and I was on the founding team of that company. I wasn't the founder or the CEO. I was just someone who was one of the first five folks there, ran BizDev. And I saw, you know, firsthand how difficult that type of venture capital growth rate demand can be. And so I actually, like I said, I wanted a company that would give me financial flexibility and independence to do things that I found interesting, go see my family in Florida more often. I'm all the way out in Denver. I've got a little nephew out there that I love going to visit, and a new niece now too, actually, just last month. And so I'm, you know, I think that when I look back on what happened, I think, and this is not meant to be sound prideful or anything, but I think I'm a little bit maniacal in my work ethic sometimes. And so, you know, I started working on S&G in earnest in January 2018, and then in May we launched our crowdfunding campaign, and we ended up doing $284,000 of crowdfunded pre-orders, which was the biggest campaign for crowdfunding ever for the bedding category, for bed sheets. And so I think that just working as hard as I did in those 4 months leading up to launch, gathering emails of interested parties, engaging our audience, creating the marketing copy and collateral and content, and, you know, putting a really strong brand around this, we got a bit of a tiger by the tail, and I love it because, you know, now we're growing something like 40% month over month, and we're on Amazon and SheetsGiggles.com, and we're thinking about expanding into other channels as well. But we've got a growing full-time team in Denver, about 7 people, and we just hired our first person from outside Colorado to move to Denver, so now we're hiring people to move into the area. So it's really been a dream come true for me to have this growth and then also do it mostly revenue funded, so that way I'm not on that VC treadmill.
You mentioned Bed Bath & Beyond has a similar product, but it's much costlier. And I urge people to go to your website, by the way, which is SheetsGiggles.com, to see what you have to offer. What is the price point and how does it compare to what is traditionally and typically out there?
So I compare to two different things. I compare to the current options for eucalyptus sheets out there, which, you know, at Bed Bath & Beyond, you're talking about $180 for a king set, $180 American for a king set. And then for, for our sheets for a king, it's about $150. And so we're about 20% less expensive than their king. The major reason why that is, right, is because if you're selling at retail, you're basically taking a markup from everything associated with selling at physical retailers. And I did a lot of work with physical retailers in my last job. And, you know, they're great people. The buyers there are lovely people. But they need to make a certain amount of margin every sale. And so, you know, whoever's the vendor of that competitive brand, and I won't say the vendor name, obviously, because they're a competitor, but they are probably giving Bed Bath and their other retail partners anywhere from 20 to 50% of every single sale. And a lot of people don't realize that that's kind of just the way the retail model works, is if whatever you're paying for in a physical store, you're generally paying some markup around 20 to 50% compared to what the brand itself would be able to sell it to you on their website. And that's just the retailer markup. And some things you've got to buy at retail. I mean, clothing is a category that's notoriously hard to buy for online. But bed sheets, no, as long as you've got really aggressive return policies and you're willing to stand by your products, I think that buying online is a total snap.
And again, we have less than a minute. The website is SheetsGiggles.com. How wide of a variety do you have in products, and is that growing as the company gets larger?
It is, yeah. So we've got bed sheet sets. We've got fitted sheet only for folks that don't like top sheets. That was a popular demand product. We've got duvet covers, pillowcases. We're coming out next month with our first non-bedding product, which is still a blanket. It's a throw blanket for the couch. It's lovely. It's also 100% eucalyptus fiber. And it's actually going to be a very unique first-of-its-kind product. And then later this year, we're coming out with comforters that are, eucalyptus comforters. And they're absolutely outstanding. I'm sleeping on one right now, actually. And so we're definitely coming out with a few newer product lines, but the trick about a consumer business is that you want to expand your product lines within reason without going too heavy on SKU proliferation too early, because you're going to have really incredible logistical complexity. So I think I'm a big believer that 80% of your sales will come from 20% of your product options.
Well, congratulations on the business. Again, the company is Sheets and Giggles, and the website is sheetsgiggles.com. Colin, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Absolutely, Peter. Thanks so much for having me today.
Colin McIntosh, founder and CEO of Sheets and Giggles. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0525, and you'll find links to their site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
And we have a rarity for you this time around. This is an audio version of Idiot of the Day, because I simply can't believe this clown. And I don't think we've ever done an audio Idiot of the Day ever on the show. Anyway, you may recall last week when Hurricane Dorian was still a Category 5 storm and it was lumbering towards Florida. A TV reporter from Florida Today spoke to an unidentified Palm Bay man who shared his theories on how to combat the hurricane. Now, before I play this doofus, let me remind you that, of course, this is only audio. If you want to see this guy in all his glory, you can go to the Stuff File Facebook fan page where I've posted it and view it for yourself. In the meantime, here it is.
Can't see how they haven't come up with some kind of way to combat these storms yet. They keep saying, 2 days ago, 3 days ago, oh, it said this, but it's going to hit all this warm weather. All this warm weather and warm water. We have a Navy. Why don't the Navy come and drop ice in the warm water so it can't get going as fast as it's going? There's got to be ways to combat this instead of just pointing at the thing and saying, well, now it's getting worse. Yeah, we know it's getting worse, but you tell us, oh, it's the warm weather, oh, it's the wind. Well, we have an Air Force. Drive some Air Force planes around to get the winds going the opposite way. The Navy to go in circles to fight it the other way.
Wow. Why, oh why, would you even make such a statement? I think the audio makes it clear. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0525. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number. And once again, that's 0525. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Let me leave you with these words of wisdom. Never, ever juggle ice picks while standing on your waterbed.